Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome back great guest co-host, Dr. Jamila Battle. Welcome, Jamila.
Welcome. Thank you.
How's life, love, and the pursuit of happiness?
It's wonderful, my friend.
Oh, that's good. That's good. We are grateful. Having finished recently some Thanksgiving and that gratitude just being on our minds.
Pass the boards, too.
Ooh, congratulations. For our listeners out there, she passed her recertification, family medicine, the very first discipline in the country that required recertification to establish that the doctor you're going to is capable and qualified no matter their age.
Yep.
So congratulations. A hard test to do.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to be talking today, Jamila, with Dr. David Sabar, professor and director of clinical training in the Department of Psychology at the University of Arizona, about his expertise on the topic of divorce and health, something really interesting and a common area for much of the population. But first, we're going to talk about some research that matters, and let's dive right in about this very first research about smoke-free policies and the impact on blood pressure. And that may not be obvious to folks. Smoke-free policies increasingly are the norm rather than the exception in communities across the country. Things like smoke-free restaurants, smoke-free bars, smoke-free public places and arenas, even in some outdoor places like parks. Why were they interested in looking at the impact on blood pressure?
Well, because we know that higher blood pressures increase the risk of cardiovascular disease. And so they wanted to see, in this study specifically, if smoke-free policies, meaning laws that prohibit smoking in public places like bars and restaurants, which previously had been associated with reduced rates of hospitalization, maybe lowering blood pressure would be shown as well, which would then further reduce our risk of cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, and because the research showing really reduction in heart attacks, you know, maybe the mechanism is this reduction in blood pressure. And they did find that there really was a reduction in one of the dimensions, the systolic blood pressure, a very small amount. But when you take a small reduction and you multiply it by hundreds of thousands of people or millions who are affected, it could have a large impact. So I think it shows a mechanism, though we know there are lots of other mechanisms by which secondhand smoke, even regular smoking, causes heart attacks, and that's due to spasm of the artery, not necessarily the blood pressure. It's due to chemicals and constituents that are in the smoke themselves that are toxic. It could due to insulin and kind of inflammatory changes. So the blood pressure, I think this is important research, but it's certainly only just a piece of that puzzle.
It's definitely a piece, and they definitely need to look at more intense study.
Yeah, well, hopefully we don't have too many places like that. I will say one place where we could use some more study would be what happens when we eliminate secondhand smoke exposure in homes, because we have a spouse in that home and they're exposed to the secondhand smoke. They're at such high risk for coronary artery disease, their own blood pressure, strokes, cancer. So really, let's getting it out of the home entirely.
That's a great point, Adam.
Next research that matters, that ways we can stay healthy, is by having a healthy personality. Well, do we have healthy personalities, Jamila?
I don't.
I don't know. You've got laughter. That one should be one of the healthy personality traits. You know, this is the University of California, Davis. They were looking at research across kind of people that could help predict what we might call a healthy personality. They talk about the big five, what they say, major factors: neuroticism, extroversion, openness to experience, agreeableness, and conscientiousness. What do you think?
Well, they said that When you have these five major factors, there was higher levels of openness to feeling warmth and positive emotions and agreeable straightforwardness, and that these predicted life outcomes such as health, self-esteem, academic performance, marital quality, and work performance.
Those would all be good.
Yes.
And this low neuroticism, which is interesting. It wasn't just this, you know, kind of feeling exploitiveness. That's the bad part of neuroticism. But they were saying that there were some good parts. If you know, this a little adaptive aspect of grandiosity or self-sufficiency, something that's a kind of a confidence factor.
Yes.
There. And same with this healthier personality. If you didn't blame others, that was a better adaptive scale that helped you with stress.
It also even showed that these healthy personalities were able to resist impulses, regulate behavior, and focus their attention, and they had lower aggression and antisocial behaviors.
We're going to ask our friends and colleagues at the health science librarian at the University of North Carolina to put up the personality test here so you can take the personality test. You can see, are you agreeable? Are you extroversion? And see if you've got a healthy personality type. Let's talk about our next research that matters that relates to people who have dementia and whether they have guns and how they may use those guns. A pretty striking bit of research.
And this is probably going to strike a lot of controversy, but states that red flag laws allowing for the removal of firearms from people with mental illness needs to be extended to patients suffering from dementia. Researchers report that older adults have the highest rates of gun ownership, with 27% of people 65 and older owning one or more firearms and 37% living in a home with a firearm present. What are the consequences of that?
Yeah, they talked about cases of an elderly person with Alzheimer's shooting and killing during confusion, another elderly patient with cancer rejecting treatment options and, again, confusion and ending life and suicide. And, you know, this reminds me of some of the research that our group has actually done, Jamila, here at the University of North Carolina, where we actually talked to providers and asked them, should people with dementia, for instance, get concealed weapons permits? And it was a little bit all over the place. You know, certainly, I don't think many providers would say people with Alzheimer's should really have access to weapons. Someone who had a stroke 10 years ago and is fully recovered, well, maybe they could. But it really shows that we need more research, and this is the beginning of things that help us say, hey, maybe some of this is not okay.
Exactly.
You know, and then they give us a kind of some questions we should ask as providers and maybe as family members who are concerned. And it says, they call it the five L's. Is there a loaded gun in the home? Is there a locked gun in the home? Are there little children in the home? Has anyone been feeling low in the home? And is there a learned operator on safety training in the home? These are good questions. And again, we'll ask our health science librarians to put these questions up for our listeners.
Sounds great.
Let's talk about our last research that matters about having a baby up at night. Did this ever happen to you and your children?
Oh, my God. I have three. So, yes.
Am I bringing back some post-traumatic stress when I ask that question?
Triggered.
Well, it seems like I think this would be a universal question then about what might keep a baby up at night. And one of the factors they talk about is inactivity during the day. Fascinating. I never thought about this.
And it makes sense, however. In fact, babies who slept less at night, even napping more during the day, didn't help either. And it sounded like the tired tots weighed significantly more based on their length, indicating a potential risk for early onset obesity as well.
And this was published in the journal Infant Behavior and Development. And they really talked about kind of this activity during the day. Like if you lay the child on their stomach and they're kind of moving around, and that's kind of like developing motor skills, but this activity of the child moving seems to be a factor that seems to help with nighttime sleep. It might help with things like childhood obesity. We don't know that. And I'm not so certain that we thought about it. I didn't think so. You know, I want to get my child tired out, but that was like he's been screaming all day. He should sleep at night, but that's not always the case. But this physical activity, it's good for teens, it's good for adults, it's good for older parents, it's good for the young kids too, probably.
It really is. And it makes sense. It definitely does that you're promoting this activity that's sort of building sleep debt, kind of, that we are, it's a process of sleep homeostasis that is kind of like a load. And as we tire ourselves out and exercise, that gives us that load to sleep at night.
And we should acknowledge that Dr. Battle is an expert in sleep management, said like a pro.
Yes.
Love it. Love it. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. David Sabara, professor and director at the Department of Psychology at the University of Arizona, about the relationship between divorce and health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Golson, Dr. Jamil Battle. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamil Battle. Today on Conversations, Jamil, we're going to be talking with Dr. David Sabara, professor and director of clinical training in the Department of Psychology at the University of Arizona, about the relationship between divorce and health. Welcome, Dr. Sabara.
Thank you. Terrific to be with you.
You know, we've been wanting to really have this type of conversation for a long time, and I don't really know why. It's not like we wanted to avoid it, but this issue of divorce and being such a common and important issue in society, and of course, health. And we're going to have this conversation today, and so we're real excited that you're with us. But I guess we'd like to know a little bit about you first. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested in psychology and then studying and working with divorce?
Sure. I'd be happy to tell you about that. Let's see. Who am I? I'm a professor here at the University of Arizona in Tucson, Arizona, and I direct a relatively large research program where we study close relationships and health, and in particular, the effects or correlates of the end of relationships on health, and do a lot of work, as you've said, on the topic of divorce. So I've been a professor here for 15 years. I grew up in New York, did my graduate work at the University of Virginia, nearby y'all, and then did my clinical internship at the University of Wisconsin. So I slowly made my way out west. But my interest in relationships goes all the way back to when I was an undergraduate, and I started out doing a lot of work on child attachment and thinking about attachment orientations, and I did a lot of work related to child maltreatment and the effects of maltreatment on children's development, and worked at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C. for a summer when I was an undergraduate, and then worked primarily in a laboratory as a graduate student looking at the effects of divorce on children. And that would have been a big part of my undergraduate education, and toward the end became increasingly interested in this emerging field of health psychology and the idea and the investigation of how our psychological responses to life events may shape biological, physiological responses that are health relevant. And in the last 20 years, we've really had an explosion of knowledge in this field and can create very clear pathways from the experience of psychological stress to biological responses, physiological responses that may ultimately be harmful for our health and promote the development of disease endpoints that people like you and your listeners really care about. So that's a short version, but and this is where we are right now.
Well, Dr. Sabara, that sounds fascinating. And you mentioned the emerging field of health psychology, and it sounds like an expansive amount of information. What do we know about the relationships between divorce and health?
Yes, well, it was emerging a decade ago, but it's really quite established now. And my own particular corner of the scientific world in this area is about studying divorce. That is true. But I really use divorce as a model system for understanding stress and health more generally. About 40% of first marriages end in divorce. And one of the first sort of health-related studies we did was a big meta-analysis, and maybe you talk about this a bit on your show, and your listeners might be familiar, but this is a study of studies, and we did a big meta-analysis of all the large-scale epidemiological research. This was in 2011. We published it, linking divorce to the risk for early death. And so these are studies that look at people's marital status, and then they follow them over time, and some studies up to 40 years. And the basic question here is there a large-scale, broad-based association between the life experience of divorce and risk for early death? And the answer is yes. And the association is about a 23% elevated risk on average. So relative to being married or being continuously married, people, adults who experience divorce, were at risk of early death.
One of the questions I have about that is, how do we know that there's not a kind of a selection? We call it a bias, but that those who are getting divorced for reasons that would lead them, you know, anger and other kinds of stress in their life that would lead them to have that kind of consequence. Those who stay in marriage are naturally, you know, get along just well. How do we know it's not that and it's the divorce per se?
This is a terrific question. We don't know that. And so the first part is, well, I mean, I have some reasons that I can talk about to believe that there may be a causal association here. But there are all kinds of different scientific methods we can do to basically take a look at that correlation and try to understand if it is a selection effect. So one of the things everyone, all your listeners need to know about the effect is that it is an average statistical effect. And what I want listeners to also know is that there are many instances in which people are happily divorced, and they will raise their hand if I give a public lecture or a scientific talk in the back room and say, hey, Dr. Zavar, I'm very happily divorced. Are you saying I'm going to die young? And the answer to that is no, I'm not. The average risk sort of masks all kinds of variability. So we've done work to try to show who it is that is at greatest risk and then the kind of mechanisms that might drive this association. But to your most fundamental question, there is a lot of selection operating here, and we try to rule out these third variable explanations as well as we possibly can.
When you've tried to rule out those variabilities, what mechanisms have you all been able to pinpoint it down to?
Well, I'll give you one example. One of the papers we published a couple of years ago looked at the effect of divorce in a nationally, very large, nationally represented sample of people in midlife, the effect of divorce on the probability of a diagnosable depressive episode. And we used a particular tool that tried to account for these selection effects. This is called propensity score analysis. It doesn't really matter for our conversation. But the important thing here is that when we let the analysis go in an uncorrected way, we saw that divorce was associated with a risk for major depressive episode. But when we accounted for the propensity to become divorced, that is exactly what you're saying, Adam, the variables that may explain the selection out of marriage, when we account for the propensity, it was the people who are most likely to become depressed in the future were those who had been depressed in the past. And this is a classic example in psychology of what we would call a diathesis stress effect. There's an underlying vulnerability that is exacerbated once again by the exposure to a stressful life event. Depression begets depression, of course, but in the context of divorce, people who have been depressed before were much more likely to become depressed again.
You know, look at my own practice and the patients I followed for several decades. And you know, I see so many, in this case, women more than men, who are in abusive relationships or who are in relationships, and at least with, it's not physical, maybe it's verbal. And when they get out of those relationships, they seem to be doing better in many circumstances, if not most. And yet the stress of that relationship is what you're saying has and will have an adverse effect on them regardless.
We published a paper a couple of years ago now that looked at the improvements in psychological well-being among people who ended high-stress marriages. And what we saw was exactly consistent with the point you just made, that women in particular, not men, women who left very low-quality marriages were the ones who experienced the greatest improvement in their psychological well-being. And we didn't have the sort of resolution you exactly need to get in there and say, well, what was it that made these marriages so low-quality? But we were alleging that they may be situations in which there was violence or extreme conflict, and that leaving these acrimonious situations is associated with improvement in how they're doing, for sure.
Well, we will definitely need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. David Sabara, Professor and Director of Clinical Training in the Department of Psychology at the University of Arizona, about the relationship between divorce and health. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with Dr. David Sabara, Professor and Director of Clinical Training in the Department of Psychology at the University of Arizona, about the relationship between divorce and health. We talked a little bit about some of the consequences that can occur from the toxic relationship with the divorce. Are there any research specifically that discusses the domains that are affected, such as social or financial? I know we talked a little bit about attachment, but maybe looking at pieces of the social and financial consequences?
Sure. I'd be happy to talk about that. One of the things that we found in the last year, we did a very interesting study. Well, let me back up a little bit. One of the things that we had found a few years ago was that sleep difficulties in the period after a marital separation were associated with risk for future increases in resting blood pressure. And one of the things that we found in particular related to that, and you might say, well, okay, yes, poor sleep is associated with increases in blood pressure. We know that those kinds of findings. One of the things we found in particular was that it was related to the length of time after their separation. So we had people self-report on their sleep disturbance, and we also knew how long ago they had physically separated from their spouse. And within the first 3 months of the separation, sleep difficulties, sleep disturbances, including self-reported clinically significant sleep disturbances, so the kind you'd see with something like chronic insomnia, were not associated with prospective increases in blood pressure. But once the sleep disturbances persisted after a period of about 3 months, then you saw that prospective association. And what we were basically hypothesizing when we first saw this was that there's a period of turmoil that everyone who separates from their partner goes through. It's a sort of normative period of acute grief, and it's a major life upheaval, not only for parents, but for children, for family, for extended family. And there's a period that's very much associated with sleep dysregulation. But after that period, if people are still having problems with their sleep, there's more to the story. And our latest grant was try to understand what that more to the story was all about. But let me just pause there.
Well, And I think we'll want to hear the end of that story soon. But, you know, I'm really struck by the fact that, you know, I know you see patients and I see patients and you see families, and they come in and they're struggling. They wouldn't see you if they weren't struggling at some level. And I've never yet seen a marriage that didn't have struggle. And it seems to me that how couples manage conflict sometimes is the key. Are there times in which you are really saying, you know, these people aren't going to make it, and so therefore my job is to kind of help them get to that decision, or is your job just to always help them arrive at whatever decision they want to come to?
Well, I think on the second part, I do see my job as trying to help them arrive at the decision they want to come to. And I am, I guess, I was telling you during the break that one of the things that I find here that's sort of surprising is I can't predict. I have found over the course of my career that I absolutely cannot predict who is going to stay with it and who is not. And most of the time, if a couple comes in and they're under extreme stress and distress and they start fighting and there's a blow up and someone's storming out and you say, wow, you know, this is not going to work. But then you sit them down and you try to get organized and then go about delivering the evidence-based standard of care that, you know, an empirically supported treatment for their distress. Some people take to it and some do not. And it's very difficult for me at this stage, having even done it for a good long time now, to predict who will and who won't make it. And sometimes it takes quite a long time to get there.
Well, can we shield ourselves from these negative health consequences or outcomes in any way?
I think back to one of the points I made earlier, our studies of divorce are model systems for studying stress and health. And when it comes to asking ourselves what we can do during these periods of upheaval to protect ourselves, I think it really is about managing the stress as well as we can. And this is, it's very important to think about what is a healthy way to manage stress when you're living in a period of complete chaos. Like, what is the healthiest thing to do when your life is, you're moving, you're separating all your stuff? What is the best way to manage this? And one way we've come to look at this is really, I mean, the metaphor we like is to sort of ride the wave of your experience. And we try to ask people to not get over-involved with their experience, to try to not get caught in the ruminative processes about how bad and awful everything is, because that's a major risk factor for depression. And when it comes to our studies of divorce and health, one of the things that we've also found that is probably the significant driver of the effects is tobacco use and cigarette smoking. And the way I see this now, I've come to see it, and we have all kinds of prospective data of people followed over time for many years where cigarette smoking plays a key health behavior intermediary linking divorce to, you know, inflammatory processes or even diminished lung function, and then later on to increased blood pressure and then even risk for death. So the way I see it and come to see it is that the divorce experience is stressful and people have the problem of managing that stress, but they can do that in ways that are more or less healthy. And then if they start smoking, if they initiate smoking again or for the first time, they develop a second problem that they then need to manage, which is the poor health behavior. And that is the one that may ultimately be what compromises them down the road.
Really fascinating. And, you know, we've been kind of talking around the edge. You talked about early on when you kind of started your work with families and children. And I wonder if there are things that you can distill down from your research and the literature about two or three things that can help families undergoing divorce to know how to best ensure the health of their children, you know, things they could do, but also things they should avoid doing. What do we know?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, my former advisor at the University of Arizona is a person named Dr. Bob Emery. And he wrote a really important book entitled The Truth About Children and Divorce. And he studied this his whole career. So I really do recommend for families that are interested and capable to buy something to educate themselves about this period of time so that they can sort of be informed about what they're trying to do and how they're navigating this period with respect to their children. But to boil it down, the messages, there are a few important messages. The first is that it is not the life event of divorce that ultimately has any long-term bad or deleterious effects on children. It is the family conflict that is often associated with divorce. So the key job for parents is trying to figure out a way to transition, especially parents when they want to continue and are going to continue being co-parents together, to transition from a marriage and personal relationship to a successful, almost business-like or professional relationship in terms of managing and working with their kids and co-parenting together. So it is the conflict, not the divorce. And then making that transition is very important, and ensuring that kids are not caught in the middle or alienated or parentified, where they take on more responsibility than they should. And those are some very simple ways of thinking about it. But in most all cases, if you ask people what their values are, it is family and children. And reminding people of their values and having them behave in a way that is consistent with their values is very important.
So as we wrap up, are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners? You did a great job summarizing those points. Are there any final nuggets or pearls that we can drop to our listeners?
Well, what I would like to show with your listeners is that for many people who experience divorce, there is an associated feeling of shame or failure. And it's important to recognize that you're not alone in your experience, although you often feel quite alone, and that linking yourself to the broader experience of other people, we have actually found is pretty important. And so recognizing that your experiences and that the upheaval and period of transition typically lasts about a year, but resilience and doing well in time is the norm, not the exception. So as terrible as you feel in the first few months, holding out for things to get better becomes very important, and just sort of breathing and allowing yourself to get through the experience is what matters most.
Well, we appreciate you sharing your experiences with Your Health listeners, Dr. David Sabara. And we're going to put a copy and encourage our listeners to you published a book a couple years ago called Love, Loss, and the Space Between, and I think a collection of essays. I think it'd be fascinating read, some wisdom and hearing and sharing. So thank you. Thank you so much for sharing with us today your expertise and passion.
Yep,
thank you both. Yeah, thank you both.
We've been talking with Dr. David Sabara, Professor and Director of Clinical Training in the Department of Psychology at the University of Arizona, about the relationship between divorce and health. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Jamila Battle. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Jamil and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, you can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. That's one word, yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I have a history of depression, and I was just laid off from my job. For the past few years, my depression has been well managed, but I'm concerned I might experience more depression in the coming months as I'm out of work. What can I start doing now to try to protect my mental health?
You know, this is kind of a flip side of kind of what we heard with Dr. Sabara. You know, with divorce, we know this being laid off from work is a major life stressor.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's right. And certainly a big cause of depression that, you know, I'm seeing even with the changing economy and just kind of layoffs and, you know, things like that. So you're not alone. But in the wintertime, I certainly see an increased depression because it just gets dark.
Yeah, so you've got a lot of things going on here. You know, you're changing lifestyle. You may alter self-worth. You know, it's silly sometimes, but how little things, and losing a job wouldn't be little, but even things like, I remember once I didn't get a grant as an academic. It's like, could anything worse happen? And, you know, but and I went to bed that night thinking, you know, I don't have my self-worth was all of a sudden challenged. And, you know, wake up the next morning, that's just stupid. You know, but losing a job, where you might want to see is a mental health professional. Mm-hmm. Because what you don't want to do is to cycle down and understand that, particularly in this job market, you probably can find another job. It may not be at the same pay grade. It may be in a different field. It may have to make these changes. And that's going to be stressful.
It's going to be stressful. For having that support and someone to bounce ideas off of, it's going to be very helpful.
Good idea. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My 10-year-old is begging for a phone of his own. A lot of his friends do seem to have them, but I'm just curious, what's the current thinking on giving children this age a phone like this?
I don't believe in it.
That's Jamila's current thing.
That's it. Drop the mic.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, what's wrong with these parents? They waited to age 10? I mean, how did they do that? I mean, I have a friend yesterday who said their child is 5 years old and they're asking for Christmas for a cell phone. And I'm like, even that seems late to me. You know, I have parents that bring their 3-year-olds in the clinic to me, and they're on the phone and they're watching games and playing games and the iPad and everything. And I'm just like going, this is a different world. But, you know, 10 years old, you know, given lots of things in society, if there are limits to it.
Exactly.
If there are limits to it. Because, you know, one can come with lots of reasons as to communication and being in communication and waiting after school and taking the bus and parents working and being at home alone. So many different things. But, boy, there do need to be limits on that phone. It shouldn't be a smartphone.
It certainly should be limits. In fact, there's apps, if you ask your carrier, that you can download to tighten and restrict, you know, what websites that they can get on and safe, trusted contacts and limitations on when the phone shuts off even. And so my kid's in middle school and she'll say, Mom, my phone's not working. And it's like, yeah, I know. It's restricted to not work after 9 o'clock.
Yeah, you got about 10 minutes a day. You can decide, you know, when that 10 minutes. And by the way, it doesn't carry over to the next day.
Right.
Well, that's a great question. And you've heard some different views on this. Both from a parent and maybe from a provider. So thank you for the question. Laura, it's our very last house call.
I was recently told that I have polyps in my nose. The ENT I saw recommended removing them. Is that common? What causes polyps like this? And what are the risks if I decide to just leave them alone?
Well, people kind of don't really think about polyps in their nose. They kind of see them elsewhere, like these little kind of blood-filled sacs, kind of gray. Sometimes women have them on their cervix. Sometimes you can find them in the colon. People have colonoscopies. They hear they have polyps, and they're all, you know, make sure they're not cancerous polyps. Polyps in the nose, though, are this own kind of unique area, sometimes associated with things like sinus infections, that you'll see that. And people who have irritation and asthma and rhinitis or allergies, sometimes people who are sensitive to aspirin. I'm not sure why those things are related, but I know they are.
I don't know why either, but it's certainly there is an increased incidence, and they're often benign, but they can, you know, cause irritation. They can bleed. So certainly it's worth visiting your family doctor to have it checked out.
And sometimes people who have allergies and they're coming in with lots of congestion, you look in their nose and you say, oh, there's a polyp there. And that polyp could be large enough. It could be blocking the nasal passage. It could be causing irritation. And you can treat the underlying condition and you can actually remove the polyps if they need to be removed as well. So probably worthwhile certainly bringing it to your doctor's attention. You may need a referral to an ear, nose, and throat specialist as well. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. We want to thank our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. You can send us any question to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us at yourhealthradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank Dr. Jamila Battle as a great guest co-host and Dr. David Sabara as our guest today. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And Dr. Jamila Battle.
And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.